Hello and welcome to Volume 108 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the recent developments to make a national park out of the Mobile Delta. We'll discuss family succession planning, we'll discuss hardwoods, and we'll discuss how a cycle of dependency on single-family homes can be avoided. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Over the past decade, we've discovered the wood industry has a dependency problem. And the first step to recovery is to admit you have a problem. So here goes. We're the wood industry, and we're addicted to single-family homes. There, I feel better already. Bruce Lindsay from Woodworks is here to help us talk about some other options. Hello, Bruce.
Hello. It's a great analogy. I've never heard it put that way.
Well, tell me, are there other options to us that are so dependent on those single-family homes?
There are. There's a variety of options out there, but by far the broadest untapped avenue for increased wood volume is in the growth of new commercial construction. And as you mentioned, single-family construction has always utilized wood products as the primary structural component, but commercial construction traditionally has not. After World War II, there was a wealth of steel manufacturing, and there was significant growth in commercial construction throughout the U.S. And at the time, steel was cheap, it was readily available, and accordingly became the structural material of choice in much of the commercial construction industry, and that stuck. But times have changed. The increased cost of energy, the related cost of steel production, all that has proven favorable to us in the use of wood construction. There's also a high environmental cost associated with steel and concrete construction. And this increased awareness in green construction has promoted the environmental benefits of wood products and has brought about welcome attention to the sustainable role that wood products can provide in commercial construction. We also have new products, engineered wood products and other advancements that now allow us to span and meet capacities that can rival steel and concrete construction. And this is an opportunity that we've never capitalized on up until this point. Research that we have now indicates that only about 28% of the commercial structures that are suitable for wood actually use wood. So within that opportunity, we're missing out on about 72% of the market share that could be wood. So this includes lumber, panels, and engineered wood products, but right now we are just shy of 1.8 billion board feet annually that go into commercial construction. If we can capitalize and capture this, we could have an increase of about 4.5 billion board feet, and that would greatly reduce that dependency that you're speaking of on the single-family market.
Okay, so you're pointing to commercial uses of wood, which has typically not been heavily wood-dependent, but we'd like it to be more. What can be done within our industry to capture this potential market?
Well, there's a variety of initiatives being implemented to pursue this construction sector. Many of these are by the individual product manufacturer specific to unique products, but the largest of these pursuits is being implemented as a unified industry approach, and this is through the Woodworks Educational Initiative of the Wood Products Council. And this initiative is a nationwide effort funded by the Softwood Lumber Board Checkoff Program, various other government grants, and this provides resources and information to building professionals and an effort to promote the use of wood within that commercial construction sector. And this includes that the big boom we're seeing recently in that multifamily construction portion as well. And these services will include free one-on-one design assistance, education through seminars, webcasts, case studies, technical papers, code support, design guides, and all of these target the design professional community to help them clear any hurdles they encounter while trying to use wood products within their designs. What we found is that many of these designers aren't as familiar with the use of wood, and this is a bottleneck for them. And often, to avoid having to deal with that, they will simply default to steel or concrete. So having these options out there for them really helps them capture the ability to go and utilize wood in that. So it's worked well. Last year alone, the Woodworks program impacted the material choice on about 275 projects with an estimated $250 million in increased wood product volume. So we're very thrilled with how it's working.
All right. Well, thank you, Bruce. We appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Occasionally, Capital Ideas Live can truly say that we have breaking news, and that's the case with the movement to make the Mobile Delta into a U.S. national park. David Peterson from Save Our Delta has been keeping up with this issue. Welcome, David.
Well, appreciate it, giving us the opportunity to speak to you.
First, tell me a little bit the main concerns that your group, Save Our Delta, has with designating the Mobile Delta as a national park.
Well, all of this was kept under the radar, and the public wasn't even aware this was happening until July 24th this past year, when the Mobile County Commission passed a resolution supporting to renew a study that was conducted in 1979 as to the feasibility. Our concerns were what restrictions will be placed on hunting, fishing, or would hunting even be allowed? The research I've done on national parks is that's not something that takes place in them. Fishing it is, but you're sometimes required to buy additional license. Creel restrictions are greatly reduced as what you can and can't catch. It's also an issue of where would we be allowed to operate motorized vessels and boats. Would there be closed down sections? The Delta is a big piece of water. I've been fishing it for over 50 years. Would eminent domain come into the picture? Since 260,000 acres of the proposed park were privately owned lands, how would they purchase these lands? And those were some of the concerns, and the loss of hunting leases that would be affected. And one big major issue that the Baldwin County Commission, I reside in Baldwin County, had was the biggest portion of the park would come out of Baldwin County, and what would this do to our tax base and ad valorem taxes, which we fund our schools with? So that was some of the main concerns that we had with this, and we were unable to get answers to our questions. So we had no other alternative but to start a group to fight it and, you know, to stop it and try to see if the people wanting it would get on board with us and at least talk to us and let us know how they propose to do all this.
Okay, why don't you tell us what's happened recently with the status of this initiative?
Well, it was a very hot topic during the congressional campaign for District 1. It split the vote, basically. It was just about 50-50 vote, with the Delta being one of the hot issues that was there. And Bradley Byrne won the election. He had wrote a letter to us, said that he would do everything he could to stop this. And in the past week, things have been going so fast. I believe this a week. He's been in office a week now. But he has submitted a letter to the Natural Resources Committee requesting that they remove the Mobile Tensile Delta from the House Resolution H.R. 3131-IH. In a press release yesterday, it's stated that Doc Hastings, the head of the Natural Resources Committee, was more than likely going to honor the request to remove that from the Delta. I think they're going to have to amend the H.R. 3131 to do that. But it looks like right now that it has been stopped. I do foresee this not to be a dead issue, and therefore our group is going to stay together. And I just looked at it before I called in, and we had 7,142 members in our group as of this morning, and it keeps growing. So we're going to have to stay on top. We're going to keep it. We're going to try to work on some problems that have been brought to light to the public and see if we can't try to work together to resolve some of these issues.
All right. Well, thank you, David. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Rance Thomas is with Cabela's, and we wanted to talk to him about Forest Roads. Hello, Rance.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
And tell us real quickly what your position is at Cabela's.
I am the senior wildlife biologist for Cabela's.
Okay. Yeah, that obviously has something to do with the outdoors and forest land and so forth. But what we asked you to talk about was forest roads. What's the most common causes of road damage to forest roads?
You know, it's real simple. I mean, we all are familiar with the damage that timber harvest can have on our road systems, our arterial management channels to our properties. But there's a lot of other forces at work that can compound those problems and just be major problems in themselves. And the two that I've found to be the worst impact on our road systems is water runoff and vehicular travel.
Okay. Now, why is it necessary to keep these roads maintained, and can't you just build it and leave it alone?
No, absolutely not. It's because of those forces at work. Any forest land is going to – you need to move manpower and equipment around to manage that property. We all know if you turn your back on any size piece of property for any short period of time, it's going to start to change and start to lose productivity. So you have to – you know, management is a huge part of our private lands now. Of course, our business is in recreational property, hunting for the sportsman, sportswoman, and many of these people have a big interest in not only managing timber, but managing their wildlife resources and improving their hunting. So, I mean, that involves not only the management practices, but getting to and from the areas that you wish to enjoy and hunt and recreate. So, if you build it, you build it well. Maintenance is not as needed in most cases, but any road is going to suffer those pressures over time and force and even immediate impacts that may have to do with major impacts on the land with timber harvest, and they're going to need to be maintained and improved over time.
There's a couple of tools that I've heard of, a box blade and a rear blade goes on the back of a tractor. Tell me about what those implements do.
Yeah, the rear blade, I would say, is more based on the structure of your road. In building the road or taking an old road that's fallen apart and reconstructing it, the rear blade is an adjustable forward-operating implement, three-point hitch implement for mid-size compact or larger tractors. And by being able to turn and angle that blade side to side in down or up positions and then forward and backwards even, multiple clockwise and counterclockwise rotations, you can cut at different angles, different aggressive biting angles that create basically a ditch work system and pull that dirt in different directions up towards the center of the area that you're trying to manage for a road, and that creates what we call crowning. And crowning is essential to creating a good road because of the impact that water runoff can have. And when you get a heavy rainfall, that water hits the road, if it's on a flat surface or even a depressed surface, it's just going to sit there, and that causes your mud bogs and those places that you can't navigate through with two-wheel drive vehicles or anything in some cases. And you want to channel that water off of the road without major erosion, and that's when we get into what we call turnouts. And turnouts are areas along these ditches that channel that water out into a runoff area where it doesn't pile up, pull up, or back up onto the road.
Okay.
So the rear blade is really more for structural design and road creation.
Okay. All right.
And now that you get into the surface, the level of the road, we've all driven down those the roads that have the real what I call a washboard surface, especially being from, I grew up in Georgia, I live in Georgia, and Alabama has those clay roads, and after a lot of vehicular travel, you get that washboard surface, and it's like riding a jackhammer. Well, that's what box blades and grading scrapers are really designed for. After you've designed the road structure, the crowning, the ditches, the turnout, you then use those box blades to smooth and level that down and fill in potholes, and so that the road travels much better.
Okay.
And with those two design features, leveling and smoothing and grading, and a good structure in a road system, as you say, you're not going to need to maintain as often or as much, but you're always going to need to go in and make repairs and improvements, and that's what the box blades, grading scrapers, and mirror blades are for.
Okay, well, thank you, Rance. We appreciate that. Well, forest land is more often than not owned by a family, and as time passes, the land gets passed down through the family. Dr. Kelly Lacouvi has observed these issues involved in family succession planning. Hello, Dr. Lacouvi.
Good morning, Hayes.
Why do forest owners and business-owning families don't give more attention to succession planning in their business?
Well, you know, it's for a number of reasons, I think, Hayes. Succession planning is or feels almost overwhelming to people because there are so many steps involved in it. First of all, it requires a commitment of time, and, you know, most of us are pretty time-starved, and we don't have much spare time. So you need to find the time to devote to the steps involved with it and just giving the thought to it that it requires. It's also fairly complex. You know, there's multiple parties involved with succession planning. You've got estate planners and legal people and tax advice, and you know, those people can't be brought in until you have a sense of what you really want for the future of the business or the land. And the other, I guess probably one of the most important reasons or critical reasons that people don't talk about it too much is it's potentially contentious in a family. So when you've got multiple family members owning land or a business together, not everybody will have the same vision for the future. You know, some might want liquidity, and some might want to use the land differently, and just trying to get people on the same page, I think, can be a challenge. But having said that, it's a really good conversation to have. They can be somewhat stressful conversations, but, you know, once families start the discussion, it's typically a lot easier than they anticipate.
Well, give us an idea of what that first step might be in family succession planning.
Well, you know, it sounds like a really basic question, but it sometimes you're surprised by the answer you get from family members, and that is, what does this land or this business mean to us, and is it something that we want to continue to own? And for many in a family, that seems like such an obvious question, but it's not always. And you know, people have different views. They might be associated with the legacy. It might be a source of income. There's some family members that have a real emotional attachment to the land. So I think just establishing a sort of vision for the future in terms of, okay, well, what is it that we want? Do we want to continue collective ownership? Is this a source of income, a source of liquidity, a source of employment? And, you know, you might want to start with the senior generation and ask them those questions and then, you know, move to other family members and determine whether you've got consensus around that. It should be a pretty inclusive process, you know, where all of the existing and future owners get a voice.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. LaCouffe. We appreciate that.
Okay.
Jim Jeter was a guest on our first issue of Capital Ideas Live in July 2000, and we've asked him back to talk about growing hardwoods. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
What's the most important thing to consider when managing for hardwoods?
Planning. Pre-planning.
Planning or planting? P-L-A-N-N?
Yeah. Planning and okay. Following the plan.
Tell me more about the plan.
Well, you know, a lot of people want to manage hardwoods, but they in the South, we pretty well got a pine management mindset. Cut, plant, burn, whatever silvicultural practice you go through. But there's a lot of unique things about hardwoods, the many species. You're not don't really need to take into consideration just one species, but there's many species out there that grow on a range of different sites, and something that people don't think about. You know, of course, in Alabama we have I hate to call them mountains, but if you walk up them in North Alabama, by the time you get there, they're mountains. And then you get into the Delta, where you have a 1 foot elevation, is a ridge type situation. So, you know, you got different sites and people don't do enough, pre-planning to understand what different species they need to be utilizing and, you know, what is their primary objective? Do they want wildlife, species that are necessarily good for wildlife? Or do they want commercial lumber species? So
okay. Well, you've talked about planting. Let's talk about planting with a T. Do you need to plant hardwoods after a harvest cut?
Well, if you need to be able to evaluate the stand prior to the harvest to see if you have the natural ability for the natural succession of hardwoods. Hardwoods, unlike pines, will resprout from stump sprouts, coppice method, or seed in place. And if you have the right components there, you may not have to plant a single seedling. However, if you have a high-graded stand and you want to make a component change, then you may have to plant it. The other side of what you need to consider is again, your objective and the density of planting, the number of seedlings per acre you want to plant, and again, the species and on what specific site.
Can you talk a little bit about the species? How do you know what to plant in what place?
Well, we use a soil index quite a bit, and in hardwoods you have some species that are more adaptable to wet sites, such as, let's say, a green ash, overcup oak, or woodland water oak, and then you have cherry bark oak that grow on a little drier site. Then you have yellow poplar that grows on a very well-drained site. So you could have a series of those sites in one given area. So that's, the site index and the soil book is our major key as to what's there.
Okay.
And then, of course, nature will tell you, if you've got the opportunity to look at it before it's cut, you can tell, what's there naturally, even though if it's been manipulated by man. But, nature's a good indication of what will grow there as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jim. Appreciate that. I think we all know it's important to have a written contract when you sell your timber, but too often that knowledge is ignored. T.R. Clark with F&W Forestry has been around these contracts for a while, so we wanted to talk with him. Hello, T.R.
Hey, appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Why do you need a written timber sale contract?
Well, I'm glad you inserted the word written in there. The article that I reviewed by Ms. Kenny, that's the one thing I might have changed is ensure sustainability with a written timber sale contract. I think that the days of a handshake and an oral arrangement are probably have gone by the wayside. But, let's state the obvious. An oral arrangement is very risky and hard to enforce. I think she summed it up real well with the statement, the purpose of a timber sales contract is to reduce the possibility of misunderstandings and to make sure both parties are protected. And, you're going to see circumstances where even the most ironclad contract may have a misunderstanding in it, but it certainly reduces the opportunity for that.
Where do you go to get a timber sale contract?
Most timber buyers, consultants, those of us that are involved with buying or selling timber have a template of some sort that has been prepared by an attorney. And I would say that anytime you need a written instrument, it needs to be prepared by an attorney. But like I said, most buyers and forestry companies will have some type of template that can be used. She has another statement that says a good timber sales contract is one that protects the seller. It's important that landowners seek out that type of contract.
How do you know when you've got those clauses that protect a seller in his contract?
Sure. She gives a checklist, if you will, of some items that you would typically find in a timber sales contract, and I think she pretty well covers the bases. Of course, it's always a good idea to have an attorney review the contract on your behalf just to make sure that it does indeed protect you. We are a forestry consultant, and it is our job to work directly for the landowner, and it would be my assumption that most forestry consultants have a template that's geared toward the landowner's favor.
Okay. You're very good, TR. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Dr. Tammy Cushing is a frequent speaker on tax topics, and we've invited her back to speak on the topic. Hello, Tammy.
Hello.
Are there tax incentives out there that are sometimes forgotten about by landowners?
Absolutely. And in fact, our lack of using some of these incentives are part of what's putting these incentives on the chopping block as they look for ways to fix our budget woes at a national level. Some of those things get put on the block to get rid of. One of them specifically is the reforestation incentive. For those who don't know, it's a $10,000 write-off of reforestation expenses that incur during the tax year. And then you have the ability to write the rest of it off over the next seven tax years. And that's a huge incentive, but it's not used. The numbers are dismal. most times it's not used for one of two reasons. Either the landowner is not aware of it, but most often the tax preparer is not aware of it. So landowners are going to paid tax preparers who are not aware that that incentive exists.
What do you need to bring when you meet with your tax preparer, usually?
Everything. I say that it's really important that your tax preparer is aware of everything that you did during the year that impacts your forest land. Timber sales, that's very, very obvious to a lot of us, but it's often unreported income. And if the preparer is not aware that you had a timber sale, then obviously it's not going in your return, and that could get you in trouble for fraud. But more importantly, even if you had that timber sale, you want to have documentation of activities on that sale, activities on that property. So hopefully landowners have some kind of journal where they've kept track of when they were out at the property and walking the property and everything they did out there. One of the problems we're running into is our sales and our activities being considered passive in nature, and that's going to earn us another tax if we're not careful. So all that documentation, tell them you had a reforestation activity, and then tell them, hey, that incentive exists. And then if landowners receive money from government entities, cost share dollars, we have to report that as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be included, but we need to be able to tell them that we received those dollars.
Okay. Thanks, Tammy. That's good advice. We appreciate that. Well, our markets chair is Dr. Lynn Michaelis. Welcome, Dr. Michaelis.
Well, thank you for inviting me today.
We've had a sluggish recovery so far. How can we be sure that the positive news in housing starts is going to continue?
Well, first of all, you know, going back to some of Bruce's earlier comments, I mean, just make sure everybody understands that the drop in housing and remodeling from 2005 to 2009 dropped the underlying demand for lumber by about 29 billion board feet. So non-res could help, but without housing coming back, we're still in deep doo-doo. And so far, the recovery has been slow, partly because we've sat on a fairly large inventory, and the household formation numbers have been rather slow because of the poor economy. But as I look at the factors building over the next several years, the inventory is being depleted, and the household formations will ramp up. So as we look out two or three years, we should see housing starts back up to about the 1.5 million level.
What factors do you see out there that could contribute to improvement besides housing starts?
Well, obviously the other key factor is the repair and remodeling, which is the other big share of overall usage for lumber. And with home prices coming up and equity coming up and homeowner confidence improving, we should see repair and remodeling expenditures do very well over the next 3 years as well.
Okay. The Canadian forests have suffered a large beetle kill. That wood is moving through the system. Why haven't we seen more of an impact for those Canadian forest products yet?
Well, in fact, I've been giving speeches for the last 6 months of trying to get people excited about the bright future for the South. And one of the reasons why you have to get real excited about the southern timber outlook, both in terms of harvest and prices over the next 3 or 4 years, is the huge beetle kill in British Columbia. Until recently, they've actually been ramping up harvest to remove that timber. But as we look out over the next 3 or 4 years, the harvest levels will have to fall in British Columbia. Plus, there are some constraints in eastern Canada. So the one region that's the best suited to meet the growing demand for U.S. lumber demand over the next 3 years is the U.S. South.
Will we also benefit from the Chinese demand for logs and lumber?
Oh, absolutely, because the Chinese demand tends to pull some of the Canadian product offshore, and it also, the logs sort of limits the capability of the western region to ramp up lumber production as well. In fact, one of the big differences between the South and the West is the West basically has ramped up harvest a little faster and has seen better price improvements than the South so far. But because of that pull on log exports, it also suggests the West is going to have less capability to respond to the rebound in lumber demand than the South will be.
Why are they not able to ramp up their harvest and meet the demand in the West?
Well, one of the things that's really important, and I've got some slides that look at that, is when you look at the huge drop in the harvest levels in the South has accrued a fairly large deferred harvest volume, which really gives it a lot of capability. In fact, it's one of the reasons we see so much investment interest in building sawmills in the South is there's a fairly large slug of timber that's grown on the acre. I'm sure that some of your owners have felt this. And In the West, on the other hand, there's really not been that big of an accrual of excess timber, so the West just won't have the capability. In fact, in the West, timber values have been so much higher. Mill margins in the South, in the West, have been rather depressed, unlike what's happened to mill margins in the South.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Michaels. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Bruce Lindsay, David Peterson, Rans Thomas, and Kelly LaCouvey. And we also appreciate the contributions of Jim Jeter, T.R. Clark, Tammy Cushing, and Lynn Michaelis. The recent decision not to pursue a national park for the Mobile Delta highlights an interesting assumption. Does it make sense to take privately owned land, convey it to the federal government, whose job it would be to make it then reavailable to its citizens? Is there a crisis to be solved? Do you believe the government has the capability to manage the property? Well, one thing's for sure, every acre held by the public is one less acre that can be held by a private party. So, for now, that property is productive taxpaying property serving the needs of its owners. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.